You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although Frederick Douglass, pioneering aviators John Alcock and Teddy Brown, and former Maine Senator George Mitchell may not appear to have much in common, they're linked by, among other things, geography, and their stories converge in Colin McCann's latest novel, Transatlantic, when each of them, in one way or another, makes his way from North America to Ireland. The book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it has brought National Book Award winner Colin McCann back to our show today. Hello, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Now, you had a number of transatlantic crossings you could have chosen, but you chose these three. Frederick Douglass arriving in Ireland in 1845 after the publication of his autobiography, Alcock and Brown making the first nonstop transatlantic flight from Newfoundland to Ireland in 1919, and Senator Mitchell negotiating Northern Ireland's 1998 peace agreement. You start with the flight. Is that where you started when you were thinking of writing this book?
No, I actually started because I was obsessed by the image of Frederick Douglass landing in Ireland in 1845. What a story. A black American slave comes to Dublin, and he was still a slave at that stage.
Wasn't he escaping, to some degree, the possibility of being arrested and sent back to
being kidnapped and made a spectacle of by his quote-unquote owners. And so Chapman and Garrison and the other abolitionists over here said to Douglass, why don't you go to England and Ireland and go on a lecture tour and sell your book and whip up some support for the abolitionists? So Ireland was like a trial run for him. But then when he went over there, he felt completely liberated. It was an extraordinary time for him. But he also came up smack bang against the Irish famine. So it was, in many ways, he became a metaphor for me, an early metaphor for me, for Mr. Obama and the contradictions that all these political figures have to face. And how do you juggle, two contradictory ideas and hold them in the palms of your hand at the same time?
So do your books often hinge on a metaphor? Your last novel, Let the Great World Spin, for which you won the National Book Award, was also structured around a historical event, Philippe Petit's 1974 high wire walk across the Twin Towers. And you told me at the time that it was an analogy for 9/11.
Right. Yeah, the tightrope walk for me was absolutely an analogy for 9/11. The transatlantic journeys are a different sort of, and they're not so grounded. They're more ethereal. And I was taken by Douglass, as I said, but then by Alcock and Brown. I always thought that Lindbergh was the first guy to make it across the Atlantic.
Well, he did a solo.
Exactly.
And these are two men together.
Yeah.
So
but
they
basically, they went across in what amounts to a boat of air and two Rolls-Royce engines with a bit of canvas and some string and it was an incredible trip that they made in an open cockpit right across the ocean. Incredible.
Well, they went from Newfoundland to Ireland, so that was the shortest hop you could have possibly have done.
Yeah, and they arrive at a very alternative airport, a bog in the west of Ireland.
So you began thinking about Frederick Douglass, but you start your book off with their flight.
Yeah, because I wanted to land the reader in a certain way and land them and throw off expectations of a chronological narrative. And one of the things that I wanted to do also was bump it up against the present day. And that's when I enter the story of George Mitchell.
Well, how long did it take the Alcock and Brown to actually make this flight?
16 and a half hours.
Wow.
I was complaining.
Well, they were going over there really scary part of the North Atlantic. If you
sure.
go by boat, you're almost guaranteed to be hit by a storm.
Right. And they were hit by a storm, and they were hit by all sorts of weather. They didn't even have a gyroscope. At one stage, Brown said that the snow was coming in at his feet, and I love to think of it as like two figures sort of pelting through the snow. And if you look down on them, you see all this white snow moving through the air.
Then they arrived in Ireland. Did they have a smooth landing?
No, they ditched. This was the thing, which was kind of wonderful. It was like an Irish welcome for them, because the bog looked beautiful and green. It was sedge grass. And then they hit, and then it started to catch, and then they sort of flipped. But they survived, obviously, and a huge hero's welcome in Ireland. And then they went on to England, where they won £10,000. Which in 1919 was an awful lot of money.
And encourage others to make similar trips.
Yes, I mean, everyone who came afterwards, but still pilots to this very day, they have no idea how these men made it through the weather that they made it through.
Well, but this book isn't just about those people. You've created characters as well to develop some kind of 6 degrees of separation here.
That's right. I want to question the notion of what's fiction and what's nonfiction. So I have these three sort of linear male quote-unquote nonfiction narratives into which I insert these women stories of women, and then afterwards I take on the stories of the women and create a fiction into which the male characters go in. And so the book, I hope, folds over onto itself and questions what's real.
But the historical parts are accurate, aren't they?
They are almost forensically accurate. And that's the thing. I had a fantastic time with them, Senator George Mitchell and his wonderful wife, Heather Mitchell, who she understood my creative process from the get-go, because I called her and said, I would like to write about your husband, whom I admire greatly, but I would like to imagine his life. Will you give me the freedom to do so? And she did. And then I imagined him for about 6 months and gave her drafts, and she helped me work it out until finally we gave it to Senator Mitchell himself.
And what was his response?
It was fantastic, actually. His response was exactly what I expected from a man of such sort of grace and dignity. He said I had been too nice to him. And I just think that that's the only response that a man of his sort of demeanor can ever give.
Well, he was, I think, the last Senate Majority Leader to actually be able to get effective legislation through.
That's right. I mean, as the second most powerful man in the United States, under Bill Clinton, he did absolutely extraordinary things. And his name, because of his quietness, because of his graciousness, is not as well known as it should be. But I know the history will mark him in an incredible way.
My guest is Colin McCann, whose follow-up to his National Book Award-winning novel, Let the Great World Spin, is Transatlantic. Let's talk about Frederick Douglass. The narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass is often read in American literature courses throughout this country. Is it read much in Ireland? Are people even aware of the fact that he toured Ireland?
People were not aware whatsoever until, say, the early 1990s, when academics started to go in and question the notion of Irishness and then twin this with their African American narratives. And then Obama came in 2011 and he quoted Frederick Douglass.
Now, had there been many people from Africa in Ireland? There were some in England.
Yeah, there'd been a couple who'd been on the abolitionist circuit, but very, very few. Sure, I remember growing up in Dublin in the 1970s, and if we saw, say, Phil Lynott on the streets of Dublin, who was the lead singer from Thin Lizzy, we'd all go into a frenzy. Occasionally, there were like basketball players who would come from America, or surgeons. We had the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, so surgeons from wealthy African families would come over.
Well, the abolitionist movement was really big in England, despite the fact that the British were so involved in the slave trade.
That's right.
But not Ireland, I imagine. No. Ireland had its own problems.
Well, I mean, many Irish people considered themselves to be in a form of slavery, and this was Douglass's dilemma. Did he look at these poor Irish people who were starving at his feet, and were they free or were they not free?
You actually quote passages from Douglass's narrative.
That's right.
How did you pick them, according, I assume, to how they related to the rest of the story you're trying to tell?
Yeah, I wanted the reader to be in his head for just a little moment or two, although I acknowledge at the end that one or two of the phrases actually belong to me, because I like messing with the idea of what's true and what's not, but to get the texture of it entirely right.
Well, there is some of the feeling of John Dos Passos' approach to writing, where you have headlines and you have quotes from slave sales and things like that.
That's right. I'm using that sort of pastiche technique. You know, Douglas almost killed me. I mean, I had a really hard time trying to catch him. First of all, because he had such a beautiful voice himself. And secondly, because he was such a contradictory character. Because he's a dandy. He was 27 years old. You know, the Victorian women of Ireland, they all wanted to go and have a picnic with him on the banks of the Dodder, you know. And yet, he was still a slave. And he's very clued in to what social justice was.
And he was a runaway. And you've created a fictional character, Lily Duggan, who's also a runaway.
Ah, you got it. You're the first person to get it. That's exactly what I wanted to have happen in the mind of the reader.
So this is where you then can use Douglas as a way of talking about things that were going on in Ireland.
Yeah, because she's a white runaway, and part of it is that she has to come to America to liberate herself, and she's almost an exact reflection of what Douglas is, but on, you know, male, female, Ireland, America, all these things clashing together.
You give us details of Douglas's life after his autobiography stops, like how he lifted barbells made from melted slave chains every night. Is that really true?
Well, if you go down to Washington, D.C., and you go into his home, you will see by his bedside that he had barbells. So I went down there and I researched him very meticulously. Now, so at one stage in his life, he had barbells. Did he have barbells in Ireland? I don't know.
But you have him bringing them with him, 12
yes.
and a half pounds each.
Yes.
You write that he lifted them because it was exhaustion he wanted. It helped him write. He needed each of his words to appreciate the weight that they bore.
That's right. He bore.
I suspect that's to some degree autobiographical.
Well, so much is. I mean, every word that you fling against the page is sort of autobiographical in a sense, especially when you're not writing about yourself. And so, yeah, that part of that difficulty was me trying to lift up those barbells alongside Douglas, but also to get a measure of this man.
Now, the last time we spoke, you talked about, it was after 9/11, you right. talked about finding meaning and metaphors in everyday life. Is that something that comes naturally to you?
It's become more and more important to me to find the dignity in the supposedly anonymous, to find the fact that every single person around us has a story and a necessary story to tell, yes, and how the ordinary fits in with the extraordinary.
And as you said earlier, you like the idea of blurring fact and fiction, but you've
right.
also said that fiction is sometimes truer than what we call fact.
Yeah, I think we can manipulate facts very easily. I think we can use facts and stack them up against one another and make a lie out of them. And because things that are held too tightly as a fact often become a lie. You can squeeze the truth out of them. Whereas with fiction, because it's sort of looser and freer and more imaginative, you get hopefully to a deeper human truth about what's going on.
Are you surprised that Americans don't know some of these stories about their own heroes?
Not really. I mean, I didn't know all that much about Alcock and Brown before I went
yeah,
on.
Yeah, we all know Lindbergh.
We all know Lindbergh, but we don't know Alcock and Brown. And quite honestly, you know, I'd heard a lot about Senator Mitchell, but I didn't really know who he was. And I had a fair idea who Douglas was. Now I know them, but that's part of the journey. I love the adventure where you just take off and become these different people.
Is this also, to some degree, a reflection of your own life? Because you have one foot in the United States where you live
yeah. And
one foot still in Ireland?
I think so. It was the first time that I really wrote backwards towards Ireland, and I felt like I was going home, sort of transatlantic. It's quite a long way to straddle, though. You got to be careful in gymnastic if you're going to have one foot in Ireland and one foot in New York. But no, you have to be sort of imaginatively agile. And I don't know where I come from really anymore. I would say, if I was forced to, that I'm an Irish writer, but I live in New York and I hold two passports.
Well, so many Americans came from Ireland and from Italy and Russia and
right.
From Africa and all over the world. And at a certain point, the transition occurs, and I guess it's in the next generation.
Well, it is, but also the incredibly important thing to me is to say that America also exports itself in ways of grace and charm. Like the fact that Senator Mitchell went over to Ireland and worked there for years, and he got paid a big fat zero from the Irish government, and the American government did it because he needed to do it and wanted to do it, is astounding to me. And we can't forget that we always think of America as accepting people, but there's so much that goes outwards that's beyond, say, McDonald's and corporations. There's so much goodness goes out too.
Most of the other things that would cause resentment.
They would cause
resentment.
Hollywood, yeah.
The American cultural hegemony.
Right, but let's not forget that there's some really good stuff happening, and it's difficult to write about what's good and right.
Colin McCann's latest novel is Transatlantic. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.